integrity in each of the services is also critical to a strong military. General Amos, I have become friends with Major James Wyrick, United States Marine Corps, who I sincerely believe is a man of integrity. Did you fear Major Wyrick at any point?
My name is James Wyrick, and this is Military Justice, my podcast about the system of justice that governs those who protect our nation.
As the senator said, I served as the chief prosecutor for the Air Force for 4 years. And during that time, I had the opportunity to supervise 18 wonderfully dedicated prosecutors who did everything in their power to combat sexual assault. But there were only so much they could do because of the system. I served my entire career as a JAG. I loved the United States Air Force. My father was career Air Force. My grandfather was career Air Force. My family's dedicated 70 years to the United States Air Force. This is not an anti-military position. Nobody standing behind me is anti-military. They are all very pro-military. But over the last 23 years, I've heard the voices of survivors who are not being taken care of. And that's why I stand with Senator Gillibrand. It is vital at this point to align military justice process with something comparable to what they would get in the civilian world. We know a very small percentage of victims report. And of those few who do, 60% state that they were retaliated against in some way. We know only a few hundred cases result in convictions of sexual assault in the military each year. Only a few hundred. There are reports of 26,000 cases of sexual assault, yet only a couple hundred result in convictions. Our sex offenders know that they can commit these offenses almost with impunity. That must change. After 23 years of seeing how our military process is often there to deny justice to victims while protecting their predators, it is time for fundamental military justice reform. I wholeheartedly agree with the reforms start by making independent military prosecutors responsible for the decision of whether serious crimes such as rape, murder, and sexual assault should be prosecuted and what those charges should be. Many Americans would be surprised to find out that somebody other than a prosecutor makes that decision in the Air Force. Currently, we have a system of justice unlike any other in the United States, in which a person who is not a lawyer and without specialized training or significant experience in military justice or criminal investigations makes these weighty decisions. In the military, a commander serving as a convening authority makes the call of whether a case should go forward or not, what the charges will be, and who sits on the jury. The convening authority is not legally trained. He's an officer with an entirely different skill set, usually in waging armed conflict, such as a pilot, a ship captain, and an infantry officer. For that skill set, they bring decades of training and experience, and in that they excel. The same cannot be said for military justice. They do not possess the skills required to determine the complexity of the right course of action and allegations of criminal misconduct, especially sexual assault and rape. It takes years of experience to become proficient in the prosecution of complex cases. By the time I became the chief prosecutor of the United States Air Force, I had tried over 150 courts-martial and presided over another 100 as a military judge. I had 19 years of experience when I took the job, and I was still learning things about prosecuting sexual assault. It is simply unfair to victims and to the accused that a convening authority makes these weighty calls based on only a few hours of legal training.
Welcome back to Military Justice, and thank you for being here. Today we have Colonel Don Christensen, retired Air Force Colonel, Judge Advocate, or JAG. He was the Chief Prosecutor of the Air Force, and as you heard in that introductory clip, he is President of Protect Our Defenders. Protect Our Defenders is an organization dedicated to reform of the military justice system. Colonel Christensen is an eminently qualified expert, and as you'll hear in this interview, he has some great insight on the military justice system. I thank him for being here. I thank Protect Our Defenders for all they do, and I thank you all for listening. How are you, Colonel?
I'm doing great, thank you. How are you doing today?
I'm good, good. Before we get into the current day, if you don't mind, give the listeners a little sketch of what your Air Force career was like.
Sure. I joined the Air Force in 1991 as a ROTC commissionee. I took ROTC in law school. And then over the next 23 years, I was a JAG. Served at base level several times as a prosecutor, as an area defense counsel, as what we call it, circuit defense counsel, the senior defense counsel, as the chief trial counsel for Europe, which was basically chief prosecutor in Europe for 3 years, as a staff judge advocate, as a military judge. And then the last 4 years of my career, I was the chief prosecutor of the Air Force, and I also headed up the government appellate division for the Air Force.
Oh, I spent time at our appellate division. I really liked that. That was a good tour.
Yeah, it was a great tour. It was a great opportunity to be both in the trial world and in the appellate world at the same time.
So what was your last job in the Air Force?
That was the chief prosecutor.
Okay. And then when you retired, did you go directly to Protect Our Defenders?
I did, the next day.
What's your organization's mission?
Our mission is to give voice to sexual assault survivors. That is through an ability for them to speak out about what's happened to them throughout the justice process, through the command system, to provide them legal assistance through our pro bono network, to also, very importantly, to drive both legal changes and cultural changes within the military. We're very active in pursuing legislative fixes to the current military justice process and into working to ensure that all military members have access to a fair justice system and all military members have access to a work environment that is free from sexual harassment, racial discrimination, sex discrimination, misogyny, those kind of things.
Yeah, I think that I've recently done a couple shows about the Marines United, you know, revenge pornography scandal. And I think it maybe opened my eyes a little more to how we really still need to improve the situation, especially for our more junior female members.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the things we hear about a lot from people who call us is just the severe and persistent harassment that they're going through, whether it's from their coworkers or all too often from their chain of command.
I had a guest on recently of a former Marine, Elliot Ackerman, and he thought, I don't have any way to prove this, but he thought part of what's exacerbating it is the fact that, you know, our militaries really are down on their deployments now, and there's more time to just be kicking around and getting into mischief and being, I don't want to say mischief, that sounds kind of degrades what it is, but to not focus on a mission and then these other things start to creep in.
Yeah, I think there's some legitimacy to that. I don't want to go too far because, you know, the numbers show that unfortunately sexual harassment, sexual assault are occurring in deployed environments as
right.
Well. The VA came out several years ago and showing that 1 out of 4 women who deploy are sexually assaulted during that deployment. And we hear from lots of survivors and lots of women who have gone through the sexual harassment in a deployed location. And so, you know, I think it could be worse now that there's less to do, but I think even when we're at high ops tempo, it's still there.
Yeah, it's kind of unfortunately, it's with us at all times. Military Justice is brought to you by the good people of ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Do you know where to go to post your jobs to find the best candidates? Well, it's ZipRecruiter. In fact, just this past week, I was at a party talking to a longtime family friend and business owner, and I mentioned that I was just getting sponsored by ZipRecruiter, and she said that she used it and got great candidates through it. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100 plus sites in one click. Then the powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anybody else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of the jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get qualified candidates in just 24 hours. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, the listeners of Military Justice can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/military. That's ZipRecruiter.com/military. One more time, to get it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/military. Thanks for supporting our sponsors. It allows this podcast to continue. So, and this is something that I've kind of wrestled with, the idea that, and we keep seeing it through, especially the senior ranks, we have a lot of senior officers, usually men, who are involved with extramarital affairs or sexual assault or, you know, something along those lines, and how that must make the young service member, female service member especially, feel when she has to report something to her chain of command.
Yeah, this is one of the places that I think the military is failing at the highest level and to the greatest degree, and that's the absolute refusal to hold senior officers, especially generals and admirals, criminally responsible for criminal misconduct. And I think I find it ironic that the military continually pushes back against reform because they say they need to have control of the military justice system because that's how they ensure good order and discipline. But the very tool that they demand to be in charge of, the military justice process, they refuse to use against senior officers who strike at the heart of discipline and the heart of good order. And what you see is way too often senior officers who apparently view female subordinates as nothing more than a dating pool. And despite the fact that that's often going to be fraternization, often going to be adultery, clearly going to be not professional relationship, all of which are crimes under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, there's an absolute refusal to prosecute admirals and generals for that kind of misconduct.
And this is an ongoing debate that I've kind of had with some colleagues is, do you think that we could actually have a general court-martial of a 3-star general?
I think we could. I think the problem is that it's been so long, basically in the Air Force, never, that we've prosecuted a general that it would be like learning to ride a bike all over again.
Yeah, I'm just wondering from the, you know, for the listeners, for the most part, your jury pool, your members at a court-martial, they're supposed to be senior in rank. So either
– right.
And so if you have a 3-star, just finding that, you know, bringing together your members pool, there's just extraordinary difficulty in that. I mean, just logistics-wise, you know, we don't have that many – I mean, maybe the Pentagon, but other than that, there aren't that many – the Marine Corps, I think we have 64 generals. That's it. So if you're – there's 12 3-stars and maybe two – we have two by statute and another two sometimes 4-stars. So there's barely 20 of them.
Right. Yeah, and so I think this is where you have to look at the exact language they use, AMJ, and look at thinking outside the box. So the DCMJ requires that the person be senior rank to the accused, or practical.
Right.
Well, maybe it's not practical. Maybe you're going to have to put junior people in there. The other thing is there's no requirement under the DCMJ that a Marine be court-martialed with only Marine and Navy courts members.
Oh, yeah, right.
You could go to the other services. And then the thing that to never forget is that you can always recall generals to active duty, and they were almost, if they are retired threes or fours, they're going to be most likely senior to a three-star. But, yeah, it's a problem. And, you know, look, I think the crime rate, and I don't think this is unreasonable for the American people to have this expectation or requirement, that the crime rate among general officers should be zero. They've had this time, by the time they become a general officer or admiral, they've been in the service for 30-plus years. They know the drill. And it is not too much to ask for them not to commit crime. And I think the crime rate is astronomically high among the general ranks when you consider there's only a handful of them, yet it seems like almost every week we hear about another general or admiral committing a crime. So it should be a relatively rare occasion that we have to prosecute them. But as long as we refuse to prosecute them, they know they basically can commit crimes with impunity.
Right, and that the crime. Yeah, the worst case scenario for them is retiring with a letter in their file, a letter that doesn't do anything anyway. I mean, it's you're a bad boy letter.
Exactly. And the real problem of this is there's no public accountability, because as you know, that letter is going to be covered by the Privacy Act. So American public, even if they know about it, are never going to see what the letter actually says. But we're most likely never going to know about. The only reason that the American public and any junior service members know that there's any accountability is if you have a leaker. You know, we basically, our knowledge of general officer crimes is only because somebody inside said we're going to go to the media with it.
Oh, yeah. I recently had an interview with Craig Whitlock of the Washington Post, and we were talking about the Navy's Fat Leonard scandal. And he has been at war with the Navy Yard trying to get those records. I mean, there could be up to 200 senior officers that were involved in that, and he's just getting stoned at every turn trying to get some accountability out of them.
Right. And that's one of the huge weaknesses, I think, of the military justice system that nobody really talks about, is its opaqueness. That because, unlike any other justice system in this country, it's covered by the Privacy Act. And so it allows the military to hide behind the Privacy Act. And that's really what they're doing. They're using it as a shield. They know it's a shield there. And it gives them cover to tell reporters no. And yeah, look, you know, the American people pay generals and admirals really well. I mean, I don't think the average person knows how well these guys and gals are getting paid and how well they're going to get paid in retirement. So they have a right to know when they fail to meet standards, but the military doesn't seem to see it that way.
Well, I've kind of had that as a pet peeve or a pet issue for 10, 12 years now. When I was at Navy Marine Corps appellate government, I had proposed that to the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. I went to the CAF judges and asked that we move to a PACER system. So the federal court system has this system called PACER. Every American can just get an account. You can, I think they don't even charge you if you use a certain amount per year. I've had a free account for years, and it just seems like that's so much more professional than, because sometimes I just like to look at the filings in a case, you know, look at a motion, and it's not something that I need to justify through the Privacy Act to try to get a FOIA request. I'm just interested in the filings in a case, you know? And I think that,
absolutely.
I think it's really unconscionable that we don't have that in the military. And I'd have researched it. In fact, it was possible to do. It's not difficult to do at all. And I think that that would go a long way in helping us explain, lift the veil on our justice system.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And it's way overdue. And it's something that, you know, the public has a right to know, and the media has a right to it. And I think when you compare to the openness that we see in the civilian world versus what we see in the military system, you know, it's shocking. As soon as somebody is under investigation or charged in the civilian world, you don't know about it. They're arrested, you don't know about it. If there's any kind of court proceeding, they're going to know about it. In the military, you only know about it if you're really lucky and stumble upon it. And you often see where, even though, especially the more senior the person becomes, that they are being charged, the military will refuse to give the charge sheet. Or if they give the charge sheet, they'll redact the accused name from it. It's not until there's that first public hearing, the pretrial hearing, the Article 32 hearing, that anybody can contend that that information will get out. And I think what, you know, going back to what we talked about before, the different spanks or different ranks out there, in other words, junior people get treated much more harshly than senior people do, is that they don't have that same concern when it comes to, you know, a private or Airman Basic, that guy's name gets out immediately. But if it's a general officer, 06 or above, very hard to get that information.
No, and going back to earlier in my career, I can't remember if it was the same later, but earlier in my career, they would, you know, all the non-judicial punishments and, you know, the relatively minor ones would be printed in the base newspaper.
Right.
You know, that was they wanted to advertise that. And yep. And I think that one of the problems I have with all of, or many problems, but one of the problems I have with all of this is, years ago, there was this mystique about generals that they were these infallible individuals, you know, to never be questioned. One of the good or bad or downsides that we have with social media is our young service members are so bright and so connected, and there are no more secrets like that. They know if the general's using his driver in the wrong way, you know, because somebody posts about it on social media.
Right.
And I think letting that slide and not holding them accountable is one of the worst things for morale, because people know so much about it now.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you know, you're right. There are junior service members are very bright, and they know that when a general is out there misusing travel cards and staying at hotels they're not supposed to be staying at and taking their family on trips and costing the government $100,000 or more dollars and then getting away with it with a stern reprimand. They know they have buddies that inflated their TDY voucher by $500 and went to court.
Right. So
they see the difference. You know, their buddy goes to jail, the E3 goes to jail, and the 07 or 09 retires as an 08 instead of a 09, and he's getting $150,000 a year the rest of his life.
So I got to ask you this. What do you see as the worst case scenario if military commanders were removed from the prosecutorial decision making? You know, I hear that as like they have to have this control. But what do you see as the possible worst-case scenario downside?
Well, I guess it depends on, you know, what we're exactly talking about. Because one of the myths, I would say, about military justice, and it's often perpetuated by those who oppose it, like Senator Graham, reforming military justice, is that the idea that every commander in the military has this ability to send someone to trial, and this ability to send someone to trial is what keeps troops in line. Well, the reality is, there's a little less than 15,000 commanders in the military. Out of those 15,000, only a few hundred actually have general court-martial convening authority to send somebody to what we commonly euphemistically say a felony trial, and only 1,000 or so have the ability to send someone to a special court martial or a misdemeanor trial. The reality is that every day most commanders do their job without the ability to send anybody to trial. 97%+ have no ability to send a sexual assault case to trial. It's only a very small percentage of them that do. So I would say it's hard for me to come up with worse consequence, because I really don't think there is if they lose this authority. If these 3% of the 15,000 commanders give that authority to a prosecutor, I really don't think in any way it hurts good order and discipline.
I think I agree with that with felonies, because if somebody's going to commit a sexual assault, they aren't deterred from doing it because, well, my commander would be mad at me. You know, it's illegal, those felony type crimes. Now, the other more administrative type crimes, I do still see a role for a commander, because the, you know, being 5 minutes late for formation, you know, not wearing a uniform correctly, these are kind of non-criminal, more administrative type punishments that I think the commander still needs to have, because that's just kind of keeping people in line.
Right, and I agree with that, and if you look at what Senator Gillibrand's proposing, that's exactly what happened. The criminal cases, what we would commonly think of a criminal case throughout American society, would be handled by prosecutors. Discipline issues would be handled by commanders. And commanders would retain two tools that they have right now, basically three tools that they have right now. The summary court-martial, which is, for your listeners, a court-martial only for really practically E4s and below, where they could be put to jail for 30 days. It's not really a conviction. It's just a way to handle a discipline issue. The Article 15 non-judicial punishment that all commanders have now and would retain, and to the most extent, special court-martials, because sexual assault cases, penetrative sexual assault case, can't go to a special court-martial. They can only go to general court-martial. So when it comes to just discipline, they'd retain that. And I think one of the things to look at, again, talking about the myth, is that the general court-martial is rarely ever used for solely a disciplinary purpose. It's almost exclusively used for criminal purpose. The only time I can think of right now where you could say it's a purely military purpose is the Bo Bergdahl case.
Right.
That's a 1 in 2,000 kind of case that goes to a general court-martial. But even Bo Bergdahl, under the Gillibrand proposal, would still be controlled by the command system, not the prosecution system.
What's the status of Senator Gillibrand's current legislation? It went up the first time in about 14, right?
Right.
Yeah, if you could bring us up to date, that'd be great.
So I think the first time it came to vote was in December of 2013. And at that time, Senator Gillibrand's proposal had the support of 55 senators, 45 opposed, and it was defeated on a filibuster led by Senator McCaskill and McCain and Graham. It was brought up again the next year after the elections, the 2014 elections, in which 10 of the original yes votes either retired or defeated, not because they voted for MJIA, but defeated in elections. So she started out with 45 votes, again got it up to the majority, 50, 49 voted no, 50 voted yes, but again was defeated by filibuster. It was not brought up for a vote last year. A Senate procedural issue there, and she proposed it, didn't get a vote, but we expect it will be brought up by vote again. She's fighting hard to increase the 50. I think she will. I don't know if we'll get to 60, but she's committed to getting this passed.
It's been close. I just still don't fully comprehend the resistance to it.
Yeah, that's a mystery. You know, going back to what I said before, it only affects a very small percentage of commanders. And what I don't think most people understand is, so if you're a general court-martial convening authority, I'll use the Air Force because I know that is best, you're probably a three-star commander at a numbered Air Force. And Military justice is just a small slice of what that commander has to do. He's got so much more on their plate. And this is something that you can take off their plate, that you can reduce the bureaucracy. And there's an incredible amount of bureaucracy right now in our military justice process. Streamline the process, professionalize the process. And from my experience, take something off the plate that a lot of commanders would gladly give up.
Yeah, and I think that I've been particularly upset about, if you go back to, I believe it's, there's 13, where all the service chiefs, along with their JAGs, their most senior lawyer, were testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee. And what I find particularly upsetting during that testimony is they never mention the amount of time that they will give jurisdiction over to the civilians. They always keep harping on, well, the commander must have this. But I know in the Marine Corps, there is not a very uniform way of making a decision which cases go to a court-martial and which are given to the civilians.
Yeah, and that's absolutely right. And from our understanding, Protector Defenders, from our Freedom of Information Act requests we've made, is that the military doesn't even track what number of cases are prosecuted by civilians, how that interaction between civilians and the local jurisdiction was. Did we ask them to prosecute? Did they ask to prosecute? You know, how that decision is made. There was an article came out this week in the San Diego newspaper dealing with alleged misconduct by the Judge Advocate General of the Navy, and part of that involved Judge Advocate General of the Navy asking the U.S. attorneys to prosecute a SEAL. And so here we have the Navy going to the Feds asking them to prosecute a case. I think that happens a lot more than people realize. And what it really does is it absolutely cuts the legs out from the argument that commanders have to make decisions, because every day civilian prosecutors, without ever worrying one second what a commander wants to do, makes a prosecution decision of a military member. The commander has no input on that. And yet that commander, I think, would be hard-pressed to say somehow that affected his ability to instill discipline in his unit.
Yeah, and how does that – the Navy JAG has his own issues to deal with right now. But how do you honestly go before the Senate and say that it's this important, yet we don't track it, and sometimes we just want the civilians to do it? It seems like, if you were being honest in your testimony, you're making it sound like you would never give up this power. It's absolutely necessary, yet we're doing it, you know, through the back door all the time.
Absolutely, and it's not just within the United States, it's also within foreign jurisdictions. So
yeah.
Through our status of force agreements, we have ceded jurisdiction over certain crimes that our military members commit in certain countries. You know, we give them primary jurisdiction. So Korea and Japan, very concerned about sexual assault against their civilian population, now they're the ones who make the call if a Marine, for example, were to rape somebody in Okinawa. The Japanese are going to prosecute that case. And throughout this country, obviously, we know, I mean, I don't know if we'll get the numbers since they don't track it, but just from our own look at cases throughout the country, this confidence to say this happens hundreds, if not thousands of times a year, that a civilian jurisdiction prosecutes the case. And for those generals and admirals who testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee, if they really believed that a prosecutor making a decision instead of a commander making a decision undercut a commander's authority, then why did they not ask Congress to give exclusive jurisdiction over all offenses committed by military members to the military? They didn't. They couldn't do it with a straight face. And they know that it proves that commanders don't have to make these decisions.
Yeah, I've been kind of in a battle with the Marine Corps with a kind of a FOIA issue for a while. Back in 2007, there was Lance Corporal Maria Lauterbach. She was murdered outside of Camp Lejeune. and murdered by her boyfriend, who was also, he had also impregnated her. And then it kind of got a lot of media coverage because the suspect then fled to Mexico and then was later brought back. But I've been trying to get some information from the Marine Corps about why, where was the decision to give that to the state of North Carolina? You had you had a active duty Marine killing another active duty Marine. I mean, when we talk about good order and discipline, that's pretty high up there. You know, that's, and I can't find anything to show that they even made a stab at it. They just, oh, here you go, North Carolina.
Yeah, and that's the irony is that the people who oppose, whether it's in Congress or in the Pentagon, are saying that they trust the district attorney in North Carolina or the district attorney in Mississippi to make that decision, or the equivalent of a district attorney in Korea to make that decision, but they don't trust the JAG to make that decision. And to me, it makes me almost speechless, and as a JAG, I find it highly offensive. That those of us who, you know, dedicated to serve as military lawyers side by side with the other people in the service who have the expertise and the knowledge and experience, my leadership saying, I don't trust you, but I trust the guy in Colorado to make that decision. It's just absurd.
Yeah, I get that. That kind of envy when I think about our military doctors, all our physicians. It's not like the commander's going in and saying, you know what, I think we need to, why don't you just remove, you know, a spleen? You know,
right.
they have the autonomy to say, listen, I trained a lot for this. I have a lot of experience. This is my area of expertise. I will take care of this. And in the military, you're like, no, you know, it's the pilot that knows this better.
Yeah, exactly. And I've used that analogy on the Hill, and it would be like a pilot or an infantry officer going into the operating room, and the doctor must ask them for permission each step of the way. All right, well, I really think, you know, he needs a bypass surgery. No, I don't let you.
Right.
Or even telling the doctor, well, doctor, I know you think he doesn't need a bypass surgery, but I'm ordering you to give him a bypass surgery. It's absurd. Look, I don't, as a JAG, want to be telling pilots how to fly their airplanes or artillery officer, you know, how to put the iron down range. I don't want to be telling them that because I'm not qualified. And they shouldn't be telling me how to prosecute a case or if I can prosecute a case.
Yeah, and I don't know how much of this is feigned or is real, but they get offended as though, like, well, how could you not trust this general officer? It's not that I don't trust him. I just don't think he has this particular area of expertise, he or she.
Right. Yeah, you know, and look, I respected, I'm not going to say all, but I respected most generals that I knew. And I was certainly not going to second guess their decisions about the best way to handle air operations. But I never met a general who knew as much as I did about prosecuting a case. Even when I first started out, they simply don't have that experience. And the reasons and justifications we had for the military justice system and the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, or even the Civil War have long gone away. You know, we're not operating that world anymore. And when we can't have a modern justice system, it's absurd that we're denying both victims and accused the best justice system they can have. And the reality is that we can have a prosecutor-based system that goes the full range of giving real juries, independent juries, selected by randomness, the decisions that are made in the civilian world can be made the same without the interference and the perception that comes along with commanders being in control.
If you're listening to Military Justice, which you obviously are, you probably love crime podcasts, just like I do. Let me tell you about a new podcast I love. It's called Deliberations. Any true crime enthusiast who's felt a sense of injustice upon hearing a controversial verdict has wondered, what happened inside that jury room? In each season of Deliberations, a controversial murder trial is scripted and recorded, then played for a jury of improvisers who react, debate, and argue their opposing interpretations of the evidence. Season 1 explores the way a defendant's alternative lifestyle inflames jurors' personal biases and influences discussions about her character, begging the question, is our jury system flawed? The goal of this podcast is to place listeners directly inside a deliberation room and to understand the sometimes ugly process by which guilt and innocence are ultimately decided. I'll tell you, I just finished listening to the first episode of Deliberations. It's really good. They play all of the testimony that you would hear, and then the entire Deliberations is acted out. I really enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to listening to more of this. So go visit iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or, as I've been pushing, Breaker, which is my favorite new way to listen to podcasts, and search for Deliberations. Again, that's Deliberations. Listen and enjoy. To circle back to one of your previous points, I can tell you for sure, I think that having been an SJA for a 3-star, or more than one 3-star, the number of decisions that those men and women are making, I mean, we were maybe every 10 days you'd get in to see the general about a military justice matter. And they're swamped by decisions. I think if they were truly given, the option, would you like to hand these off and ensure that, competent professionals are taking care of this issue, but not every decision needs to come across your desk? I think overwhelmingly they would say yes.
Yeah, I think so too. And, the reality is that we have professionalized so much about war fighting. We're not relying on the citizen soldier called up at the last minute to go out and defend the country. We have a professional standing army. And we're at the time where we can have professional standing military justice as well. It would be so much more efficient, so much more effective, and have respect. Because right now, neither side, and I would say you can really claim there's three sides. You have society, you have the accused, and then you have victims. No, not any one of those three have confidence in the system. It's failing in all three levels. And yet, our opposition continues to obstruct anything that will bring us towards a point where all three of them can have faith in the system.
Yeah, and there's one of my last bosses, his son is now a Lance Corporal in the Marine Corps. That young man was 2 years old, on 9/11. And he's still just enlisting in droves, and they deserve a better system of justice, they can have a better system of justice.
Yeah, and one of the counterarguments we often hear that says we can't do this is the idea of military discipline in a deployed environment. And there's a lot of reasons their opposition is just simply wrong about that. First, military justice is something that there's a deliberative thought process. It's not like commander says something, commander says, you're going to court-martial tomorrow, and we're going to be... That doesn't happen. It can't happen legally. And so there is a deliberative process, a due process, to getting person from committing a crime in a deployed environment to that person being tried in a deployed environment. And the reality is that that due process that comes with it, it means that any serious offense will never be tried in Iraq or Afghanistan or Syria or wherever we're at. Sexual assault is going to be tried back at home station.
Right, yeah.
Just too many moving parts, too much lag time to get that. And so it's not that commanders, if they don't have authority, we're going to suddenly start having fragging in HUD or the enlisted are killing the officers. And I think you can look at Vietnam, where they actually were holding courts, did have a lot less due process rights. Commanders did have a lot less unrestrained authority, and that's where we had lots of fragging. So the justice system wasn't the answer. And the reality is you might be able to hold a summary court. You might be able to hold a special court with a guilty plea. But you got to bring in the judges. You got to bring in the counsel. It's just not going to go to trial. You know, it's not like 1944 Patton driving across the plains of France. Somebody commits a crime. You don't have to worry about a judge. You don't have to worry about lawyers. You just hold a court martial when the guy's convicted. Those days are gone. They're never coming back.
When I was at the Marine and Navy appellate government, they had the archives for a lot of old courts martial. And from World War II, you would see that a summary court or a special court martial would be on a card that was 4 inches by 8 inches, double-sided, and that was the entire record of trial.
Yeah. And those things are gone. They should be gone.
Right, right.
You know, the due process was lacking. Hundreds of service members were executed without a fair trial, without any appellate review. It's nothing that we need to have now. And one of the other things, too, is people don't understand. Senator Graham will often say, well, I don't want some lawyer in a faraway location making his decision, as if you couldn't have senior prosecutors in a deployed location. That's silly in the first place. But the second thing is there's already somebody faraway location making that decision.
Right, so right.
In the Air Force, almost literally every Air Force service member in Iraq, Afghanistan, Qatar, Kuwait, the convening authority, the commander that has the ability to send a case to trial, is in South Carolina, Lindsey's home state. So he knows that's not true.
Yeah, the same for us with California and, you know, North Carolina. That's where the commanders or the general court-martial authorities are going to be.
Yeah, they're not. The idea that these people that are making these decisions are in some bunker in Iraq, it's silly. That's not the way it works.
And, like, let's be serious. Anyone who's been around a general officer's staff, our ability to communicate now is not, you know, passenger pigeons. I've been in countless meetings, you know, where the Tandberg is up and everybody's from their different location is there at the staff meeting, you know, most of them virtually. So the idea that, well, I would never even know what happened with this case as it went back to the United States is really kind of laughable.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, their golden argument in their minds why commanders have to be in control is the deployed environment. But the reality is it's not used in a deployed environment the way they want people to think.
Rightfully so. The more serious the crime, the longer it takes. I mean, we had the Haditha and Hemendia murders crimes. It took them years. I mean, if you look at the Bergdahl case. It's not like it was, okay, we're going to send him to a court, you know, there. It's taking years to do this.
Yeah. Bergdahl's still not sending him to Afghanistan to be court-martialed in Afghanistan. I mean, that's reality. It just happened. I mean, if you think about, one of the most infamous cases, the soldier who went into the Afghan village and killed all the Afghanis.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Army soldier, yeah.
Army soldier. He wasn't prosecuted in Afghanistan. He was prosecuted in Washington State.
Yeah.
Crime occurred in Afghanistan. The victims were Afghani. He was prosecuted in Washington State. I mean, it's just, it's a myth. It's the best way to put it. It's a myth that military justice has to occur quickly in a deployed environment. That's not the way it works. And for serious crimes, it's not the way it would ever work.
Yeah, no, I agree. But it's a sexy myth for some reason that, you know, people have watched, you know, JAG too often as though we're constantly doing courts martials in submarines and then taking off from aircraft carriers later.
Yeah.
No, they're boring government buildings long way from everywhere else.
Right. And the Navy doesn't hold special and general courts martials on ships at sea. They just don't. You know, that's some submarine out there having a general court martial. That's not the way it works.
Although I do believe that CAF went out and did an argument at sea.
Yes, they did. An aircraft carrier.
So what are your views on increased protection for a military judge?
Here's the other problem with military justice. Hands down, by far, far margin, great, great margin, judges in the military, whether at the trial level or at the appellate level, are the most inexperienced judges in any system in this country. And that should be something that gives us pause. You know, we have a justice system that can administer the death penalty, and yet our judges are highly inexperienced. And I say that as a former judge. So one of the big problems is we rotate judges in and out so fast. It's just an assignment. It's just a step to another, too often, just a step to another assignment, nothing to do with being a judge, that they lack the experience. And I can honestly say, as a former judge, experience makes you a better judge. The other problem we have is because they can be rotated in and out so quickly and easily, as a judge, you're worried. And any judge who says they're not, I think, is delusional. You are worried about, will this decision impact my career? And I'm not saying any judge is making a decision other than they should be, but I guarantee it's something you worry about, that when you make a decision, this will impact your career. And a judge shouldn't have to worry about that. And so protection is great, I think, a great way to put it. Protection comes from having an independent judiciary that you can put them under a service secretary, you can put them under a secretary of defense. And when you go to be a judge, you can finish your career out as a judge. You know, I think it's ridiculous. To give you an example, the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, which for your listeners is the intermediate level appellate court in the Air Force, as of last summer, 2016, when they got done with their summer rotations, their summer moves, the most experienced appellate judge on the Air Force Court had been on that court for 1 year. And this is the court that's supposed to be the deliberative body to look at very complex legal issues to see if there was an error committed. And the most experienced judge you have there a year, and the vast majority of the court had just arrived. That's no way to run. You know, show me any other appellate court in this country that has that kind of junior feel to it as what we do in the military.
Yeah, and I can vouch for that. When I did appellate government work, I would cringe at having to have an argument before NMCCA, the Marine Corps equivalent to that, to your court. But I loved having arguments before CAF, because CAF is staffed by 5 civilian judges that are there for, you know, a decade. And they were so much more prepared, and they were asking you questions to help their decision, where you sometimes felt at the intermediate courts, they were just asking you, you know, questions just to kind of check the box, because they didn't have that level of experience. And you could see the CAF judges are just, I mean, wildly more experienced.
Yep, and I agree 100%. And this is not in any way negative about people serving. It's just they don't have the experience. We're fortunate that we have the quality of the judges we have on the various service courts, but they just don't have the experience. Judge Baker, the former chief of the Court of Appeals for Armed Forces, you know, has publicly said a number of times that it takes at least 3 years before you know what you're doing as a judge. And here's a very bright guy, incredibly bright guy, saying, hey, I didn't know what I was doing for the first 3 years. Well, our Air Force Court, the judges never even, it's a rarity they ever make it to the third year. In the history of the court, the average judge sits there for a little less than 2 years. That's just no way to have an appellate court.
Well, and I remember it at Pendleton, because, you know, being a smaller service and being kind of concentrated on the shores, I can remember our chief judge for a while. He knew his next assignment was going to be for the 3-star, the MEF commanding general. But he had another 6 months on the bench before he was going to work for that 3-star. And they're all on the same base. And like, what is the reality that he's going to rule on, you know, against him in that situation?
It was not comfortable. I'm not saying that particular individual did anything wrong, but we should not have set up a system that could give that bad impression to those looking at the justice system.
Right, and I think that's one of the things we, as an institution, the military, the Court of Appeals for Armed Forces, constantly talk about the perception of the fairness of the justice system. Yeah, we have all these things out there because senior leadership refuses to do things differently that, you know, strike at that perception. And one of the most critical ones is the impartiality of the judicial system. The average American understood that, for example, in the Air Force, every appellate judge, every trial judge, every senior prosecutor, every defense counsel in the military ultimately all work for the same person, the judge advocate general. The judge advocate general writes the performance reports of the senior judges and is critical in selecting he selects personally their next assignment. It's just a bizarre world. And in fact, can say to an appellate court that he controls, I think you're wrong, and I'm going to appeal that to the Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces. It's just a very bizarre system.
Yeah, it definitely needs some reform. So you think maybe a purple, a joint system is better with
the
judges?
Judiciary.
Yeah, for the judiciary and then them falling under a service secretary or falling under Secretary of Defense?
Yeah, the exact way whether each service has their own judges, I could go either way on that. But I think ultimately report to civilian leadership above the commanders and the people wearing uniforms, whether that's one service court, one trial judiciary, or that each service maintains theirs. At some point, we got to get over this idea that they all report to the judge advocate general or the commandant. And I know, we haven't really talked about, but one, the Coast Guard, that is, and I don't anyway mean to in any way sound like I'm criticizing the Coast Guard, but they're really hampered by how few courts they do, that as inexperienced as the judiciary is in the other courts, or other services, it's even more in the Coast Guard. So,
oh, yeah, they're really hamstrung by just not having enough senior people to fill those judge billets. They've got to dual hat that and be an SJA sometimes.
Right, yeah. And you're an SJA at one installation and then you go do a trial at another, and you're only basically a part-time judge. And again, speaking from my experience as a judge, that's not something you want to do part-time. The Coast Guard very well could benefit from a more purple judiciary.
Right. Yeah, and I think it was the Airman Wright case from a few years back. Again, not to pick on my Air Force brethren here, but the JAG had come out afterwards and criticized the judge for finding UCI in that case.
Right. Yeah. That was not a proud day for the Air Force. So what we had there was a trial judge using his fact-finding authority that he has to find that the judge advocate general had unlawfully influenced the proceedings in Wright and had done so to stop Senator Gillibrand because he was worried about the political implications of what was going on. That judge found that, and then in a media interview, the retired, now retired judge advocate general criticized the trial judge, which is beyond me that that was done, and apparently done with impunity. There was no blowback from that I'm aware of from the Department of Defense or the Air Force.
Yeah, I know. I happened across that. Did you ever serve with that judge, Kastenberg?
Yes. Yeah, I know him very well. I think he was a very good judge, excellent judge.
He's a great writer.
Probably the brightest judge on the bench. And, and he will never say this, but I think he paid a huge price for ruling in ways that the Air Force didn't want him to rule. I know his service record. He was a clearly appropriate candidate to be promoted to colonel, but he was passed over, and I just can't help but believe that his rulings that were appropriate and legal, but politically not popular, hurt his career.
I just wish he would write a little less. I'm reading his book right now, that, To Raise and Discipline an Army. It's 400 pages. He is a great writer. I really like his stuff. And I mean, he's really just a historian in addition to his other talents.
Yeah, he is incredibly prolific, incredibly bright, and somebody that should have stayed on the bench and should have stayed on the bench as a colonel. And it speaks volumes about the problems we have in our justice system that he was not promoted to colonel.
Well, thank you for being here. What should my listeners, because my listeners are very interested in all of this, what should they be following as far as legislative, on the legislative side?
Well, right now, as you know, we have both the House and Senate version of the NDAA. House version's passed out of the House. Senate version hasn't, but it's out of the Senate Armed Services Committee. I think what's coming out of the Senate version that is really critical is a much stronger language requiring that the service has established a military justice litigation track. What we have right now is just you rotate in and out of litigation positions, and it really makes it hard to be a career prosecutor, a career defense counsel. And Senator Gillibrand and Senator Ernst got that language in, and I think that's something to really watch. It was in last year and then got gutted in conference due to opposition from the services. And then Marines United, both houses have passed a version of a revenge porn statute, which I think will clearly get through. But the big one is Military Justice Improvement Act, which I think is the key first step to having a professional military justice system.
Where can my listeners follow you on social media?
Yeah, Protect Our Defenders Facebook, protectourdefenders.com, and we have also Twitter about Protect Our Defenders tweets that we're fairly active on, to be really active on that. So the tweets is where we can get out the information much more quickly, react to more quickly to articles that have been put out. But we also have a really big media presence. We are one of the go-to organization out there for the major media who are covering this issue.
I'll definitely put all of those links in the show notes, and I don't think it's a stretch to say your involvement with Protect Our Defenders has been a large part why you're the go-to organization.
Well, I appreciate that. We got a great group, and our founder's an amazing person, but I appreciate that.
Well, thank you very much.
Saved Rounds and Alibis. As always, this is where I answer questions from you, the listener. And it's been a little while. In fact, it's been 3 years since his release, but we're going to get an update on Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. So his trial date is set for late October 2017. Recently, the defense selected judge alone, meaning that the military judge will both decide the facts and, if necessary, decide the punishment. I think there's a couple different reasons for this, and some of this is speculation, but most of it is at least an informed guess. The judge previously ordered that the defense could not ask prospective jurors or members about their voting habits or anything about President Trump. As you all remember, President Trump has said many, many, many things about Bergdahl. You can go to a previous episode to hear all about that. And that, of course, is the commander-in-chief of the military. So the defense wouldn't have been able to ask about that. On the other hand, this may be a case that is very suited to judge alone, not necessarily in front of members. That this is a case, if we go back to the Article 32, the pretrial investigation, the defense, to a certain extent, almost pled to a short-term AWOL, an AWOL or unauthorized absence of a short duration that was ended by Bergdahl being captured by the Haqqani network, or at least the Taliban originally. So that would be a short-term unauthorized absence that then he couldn't terminate. I mean, he couldn't turn himself back in because he was in captivity for all those years. So I don't think it's out of bounds to say that that could be a clear choice on the defense's side to try the case just before a military judge, because military judges tend to be more looking just at the details, shouldn't be at least the common knowledge or common view amongst military practitioners would be that the judge alone would be when you have a more fact-specific case and less emotion. So where it might be a little more clear that while Bergdahl did leave, he only left for a short amount of time. So that's my opinion on that. It'll actually speed up the trial quite a bit because you won't have, there could have been a number of days with jury selection. We won't have that in this case. The defense and prosecution will still be able to voir dire the judge, ask the judge preliminary questions, but that goes a lot faster with the military judge alone. So that should speed up the case when it actually gets to trial, hopefully sometime in late October. A few other things that have come up is the prosecution decided to drop, I mean, this was after a hearing, decided to drop its intention to introduce statements that Bergdahl made while in captivity. So that means that anything he said while in the hands of the Haqqani network, any videos he made, any proof of life videos, they will not be using that against Bergdahl, either in the case in chief or in possibly the pre-sentencing phase if he was found guilty of any of the various crimes. So that's about all we have for Bergdahl right now. We'll definitely have more as we get closer to trial, and I will do my best to bring on an expert because I know it's always a little bit better to hear from two of us and hear about a conversation rather than me just droning on about my thoughts. So that's where we are. Judge alone, no proof of life or any of the statements that Bergdahl made while in captivity, and late October of 2017. Please feel free to ask me any other questions. I always love to hear from all of you, and maybe we'll see one or two of you at Podcast Movement. I'm getting ready to go there very soon. Military Justice is a production of Long Arc Digital Media. There are numerous people that need to be thanked for making Military Justice possible. First of all, audio. Those are the people that clean up all the mistakes I made. Hannah McCarthy, she takes care of that. Methil Talhan, she takes care of everything. She keeps the show moving along and keeps all of us on schedule. Executive producer is Dennis Robinson. You know him from Undisclosed and the wearing of underwear. And as always, Uber producer Dreadnought has my six.